I'm your host, Kevin Annett. It's September 25th, and welcome back to all the old-timers and all the new listeners, especially over in merry old England. Our report today will include input from the two ITCCS activists over there who are have been imprisoned unlawfully for reporting satanic child abuse. We're going to get to that in some of the news reports. But for those listening for the first time, you can follow us every Sunday here at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, at the BBS Radio Network. You can write to us, republicofkanata@gmail.com. We are here not only to educate, but to arm people with higher consciousness and our capacity to reclaim ourselves and our world. So our program doesn't just feature news updates and interviews with frontline activists, but also we will be featuring training workshops in equipping people with the common law, how to take back our world, starting with our own minds. Now today we have with us Peter Yellowquill from the Anishinaabe Nation in central Canada. He's going to be continuing to talk about the ongoing genocide against, well, all of us, but especially his Anishinaabe people, and the means of spiritual warfare, which he has relied on traditionally, lessons we can learn in this long battle together. We're going to get to Peter in a few minutes. Before that, we have a number of important news updates. Three of them involving, well, as I mentioned, the report from England about the imprisonment of two ITCCS activist there. Report from the Lakota Territory, the Standing Rock struggle there, the Standing Rock Sioux Nation battling the creation of an oil pipeline across their territory. And finally, the report from the International Tribunal into Crimes of Church and State, the ITCCS, which is issuing a historic report this Friday, which will be going out to 32 nations. And we'll start with that news item now. If you follow the ITCCS.org reports regularly, you'll see that last month we reported the upcoming issuing of a communique, a diplomatic communique, going out from the ITCCS Central in Brussels. This is an extended communique describing the ongoing genocide of Native people in Canada, but the related issues of global child trafficking and murder. And this Friday, September 30th, the communique will be published. You can read it at itccs.org. It will be issued to 32 nations, including a copy to Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia. Now, Russia has already approached the ITCCS in response to an insider's report from Canada back in July. You can read this at the July 8th post and at ITCCS.org. A government insider who described a plan going back as early as April 1998, put together by the Liberal government of Jean Chrétien, which is aimed at the silencing of anyone with evidence of genocide in Canada, in the Indian boarding school system, or anyone struggling to expose that. Literally, it was a black ops operation to silence whistleblowers, those with evidence of actual killings and other crimes going on in the Indian residential schools. Now, this was a state plan of state terror, and it's being described in detail by this insider. That will be part of the communique coming out on Friday. In response, Russia has actually invited the ITCS to come, and we have received news that they will receive the delegation in October, and that delegation will be asking Russia's help in shutting down the convicted parties in church and state who have already been convicted for these crimes against humanity, the people like Queen of England, Pope Benedict, who is already hiding out in the Vatican because of our conviction of him in 2013, and the leading officials of church and state in Canada. And there was also, as part of that communique, a desire to have Russia use their military and legal strength to stop the ongoing child trafficking, especially related to the Catholic Ninth Circle sacrificial cult. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about the data. We don't have the time and the hour today to get into all of this, but that is just to flag you folks. Watch out for ITCCS.org this Friday, September 30th, for a copy of that very historic communique. Second in the news, as you know, the Standing Rock Sioux Nation have been battling the creation of a oil pipeline across their territory. The Energy Transfer Partnership, which is a $5 billion operation to build a pipeline from North Dakota right down to the southeastern U.S., for, unless you've been sleeping around somewhere for 3 weeks, you won't know what's been going on in North Dakota. But it's a very incredible story how there's now 5,000 people gather there to stop the oil pipeline expansion. And the they faced a lot of violence, private corporate interests and the state police and everything coming down on them hard. Just the other day, another 22 people violently arrested. Well, September 9th, the federal court rejected the Standing Rock Band's request to halt the pipeline. And even though 1,300 archaeologists signed a petition saying that the pipeline was going to destroy historic Sioux burial mounds, the Obama government seems to be ignoring them. Big surprise there. Native youth from the Lakota Territory walked to Washington, D.C. to bring a petition demanding that this pipeline be stopped, and there's a huge movement building around that. Now, if you want to get a hold of the Standing Rock Lakota, you could use their Facebook account. They have the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe have a Facebook account. You can find them on there, although I normally don't encourage people to go on Facebook because your copyright is owned totally by that company. But that seems to be the only way to contact the tribe right now. So if you want to support them, contact them through that medium. But also we have common law activists allied with us who are going down to North Dakota to assist them in that struggle. So hopefully we'll have a more of an on-the-ground report on that in upcoming shows. And finally, from England, two of our ITCCS activists there, Lee Kant and Neelu Berry, were arrested this last month for reporting the details of the Hampstead satanic ritual abuse of children. Now, for those who don't know the story, in Hampstead, England, there was a satanic ritual network exposed in which children were being systematically violated and even killed with the collusion of the local police and the city council. Now, the other day, Lee Kant, who's been one of the activists working with us and this movement, was arrested without warrant. A policeman, Detective Steve Martin from the Bethnal Green Police Station, showed up on September 13th and arrested him without a warrant, held him in the Bethnal Green Police Station for 12 hours, and questioned him on only one issue, the fact that he had been posting news of the Hampstead ritual abuses on Facebook. Neelu Berry, who is one of his activist partners, showed up at the Bethnal Green Station inquiring about Lee, and she herself was handcuffed and arrested and held for 22 hours without charge. So they're obviously coming down on people for continuing to report these satanic ritual networks. Steve Martin, the detective, has been issued a stand-down order as part of the general stand-down order issued against all Crown employees after the conviction of Elizabeth Windsor, so-called Queen of England, for crimes against humanity in February 2013. Since that time, under international law, the Crown of England has been considered a rogue power, a criminal body whose writs don't operate anymore, who have no authority. And so the police do not have the authority to arrest people anymore in Commonwealth countries, according to international law. This standing stand-down order has been issued against the police in Canada and other places as well. But Lee Kant has issued that stand-down order to Detective Steve Martin. And we'll be following up with more reports on that. If you want to get a hold of them, these folks, write to us, republicofkanata@gmail.com. We'll forward the email to these people. And finally, I just wanted to say as well that today on the show, we will be getting into more of the details of what it means to actually be working as a frontline common law activist. Next week, I wanted to flag the show as well because one of our Republic of Canada organizers in Toronto, Sean, is going to be giving a on-the-ground report of the struggle to oppose mercury poisoning in Ontario, the mercury poisoning which is devastating the Cree Nation there, the ongoing environmental genocide today going on. And we're going to be having a report from Sean on that next week, so tune in for that discussion. And on the same show, hopefully we have Neelu or Lee on from England reporting what's been going on. So again, if you want to write into the station for any program suggestions to be involved, we're at republicofkanata@gmail.com. And a lot of the evidence we'll be citing today you can find online in one of my recent books, Murder by Decree, The Crime of Genocide in Canada. You can find that at murderbydecree.com. And, of course, the tribunal website at itccs.org. Again, I wanted to give a little bit of a background. Peter Yellowquill is from the Anishinaabe Nation, sometimes called the Ojibwe Nation. He's a survivor of the United Church so-called residential schools, actual internment camps where over half the children died, and they didn't close till 1996. Peter went through the Brandon and Portage la Prairie schools. He's a featured speaker on the evidence by which Canada, the Crown of England, the Vatican were convicted of crimes against humanity. And that can be found at itccs.org. Just go to the top of the page and you'll see Common Law Court Case Number 1, Genocide in Canada. Peter's testimony features prominently in there because he is not only a witness to these crimes against humanity and the death of children in these schools, but he has carried on the battle today. He has been targeted by his own band council at Long Plains, Manitoba, for his work, and it's showing how the government of Canada continues to target Native people who are traditionalists and who are standing on their land. So we're going to be getting into that more with Peter. Again, you know, I wanted to urge folks, this is not a simple issue. It's a very gut-wrenching, emotional issue, and there's been a lot of work for over 20 years going into exposing the genocide in Canada. And you can need to educate yourself on this. It's not a three-minute soundbite issue at all, as if anything is, but murderbydecree.com has all of the evidence that we put out in response to Canada's notorious cover-up of these crimes called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the TRC, which actually issued a Holocaust-denying report that said only 3-4% of the children died, when their own records show that over half the children were dying every year. And so we published in this murderbydecree.com all of the evidence the government censored out. And you can find that, you know, again, online at that site. So do that, you know, background research, because that's the only way we can have any kind of knowledgeable dialogue on any of this stuff, and to show how the genocide is continuing today. Part of our main focus is documenting the trafficking of Native children, which is very widespread, especially through the government system of so-called child protection. And on the west coast of British Columbia, we have more and more evidence that the Native women who've been targeted for killing are actually political targets. They are traditionally part of the clan mother system that owned and controlled the land, and so these women are being wiped out deliberately by corporations to get that land, and that's what it boils down to. We know that the RCMP and others have been involved in the disappearing of these women, and that the crimes today are linked to the residential school era, because many of the people who did these crimes in the Indian schools are still doing them today under the protection of the churches and the government. Now, that's some of the points made in the ITCCS communique coming out this Friday at itccs.org that will be issued to Vladimir Putin and 32 other world leaders. So follow that, and you'll have a better understanding of what we're talking about today, because if you're listening to this for the first time, you might think, oh boy, I've never heard of this before. What's this coming out of left field? The point is, this is based on hard evidence, eyewitnesses, and documents that have been deliberately suppressed. And we've got a whole history of that. Actually, you can follow that in my other book, Unrelenting Between Sodom and Zion, also available at Amazon.com. We tell the human story there of how this all came about. So do a bit of the research, and a lot of this will make a lot more sense. And hello, Peter. How are you?
Hey.
Now, Peter, you know, today we're going to carry on. I know for listeners who weren't here, you were on 2 weeks ago, and we were talking then about, you know, your struggle today, how the whole legacy of the so-called residential schools has never stopped. First thing I want to ask you is, when you're facing these problems today, I don't even want to call them problems because they're part of the whole genocide legacy in Canada, but we've talked about what we're really up against, not simply corruption in high places, but a whole malaise going on, a sickness that all of our people face. We're talking about spiritual warfare, and we need to call a spade and deal with it on that level. So I wanted to kind of open that discussion today with, what are your own thoughts, your own experience, and your traditions? How do you go about confronting these evils that we face?
I came just came back from the residential school, 68, 69, I guess, when I first started coming to my home community. A stranger, really, in my own land, so to speak. A stranger in my own home. I couldn't call my mother mother. But as I began to walk away from everything, I began to search out in my own way and start my quest, my spiritual quest, I guess you would. And on many roads, at many levels. At one point, I think I ran into a meeting at the Alcazar Hotel in Vancouver, just near the Beattie Street Armories, and where I was living. And there were some medicine people from Oklahoma, Ontario, that were gathering to, I guess, begin the spiritual, traditional revival, I'll call it. Nothing ecumenical. I think these were elder medicine peoples and who were given the task to preserve that part of the culture. Now, as I began to walk, I spent some time in the mountains with the Plains Cree at Mackinac's Camp, which is just west of Nordegg, Rocky Mountain House, that area, in the Kootenai Valley. As I found out, we're actually our own people, the Wandering Ojibways, we call them. But these are I found out were my blood. But the creator of all the heavens and the earth put my feet there, and that's where I began to see our culture. I began to see our people practicing those things that we see today, which were really foreign to me, yet this was my culture. This was supposed to be mine, what God gave me. But it seemed foreign, but as I began to learn, I also saw that, and they taught me, I was taught, that there is a dark side to our culture, that there is a spiritual warfare that's been going on since before the Europeans came, and in our own fashion, by our own devices, through prayer and fastings, we fought off this darkness and those spiritual forces that are brought into play. We call it bad medicine or whatever. Now, this was to really, those teachings were to really help me when I did return back to my community at Long Plain and began to see that at first glance, it looked like we were a functioning community, a functioning people. But as I began to learn, I began to see not only in my environment, but as my eyes opened in myself, the sufferings and the afflictions that we had and we had carried for years. I began to see clearly what was driving the alcoholism. Why were we so poor, so poverty-stricken? It's like a plague in a country so rich, so beautiful. And here we are struggling at the end of the month, you know, from an independent people who entered into treaty with the British as independent peoples on August 3, 1871. But on August 4, 1871, we began to feel the prick of genocide at first. And we didn't know it was genocide because it was slow and long and arduous and crushing. But as we begin to realize, one of the things I began to realize as a young man, I was 20, 21 at the time, that this form of government that we were having at the time, that was supposed to be serving our people, was actually a part of the genocide. It took me years to really see that the Indian Act is a diabolical, dastardly legislation, which its purest intent was to crush our people. we were living at that time with what they call the 60 scoops, what we call simply they were stealing our children. Many of my brothers and my sisters, cousins, were sold into the States, just taken away. No consideration for the mother or the father. And then we add in the residential school, which was really diabolical. It was devilish. It was just satanic, because who in their right mind, in the name of God, in the name of Jesus Christ, or in the name of their own government, would walk into a home, humble as it was, poor as we were, would walk in and just begin to steal the children. Steal them. There was no, I could care less about their policy. It was theft, pure and simple. And they came with guns and dogs. We have living memories, okay, of mounted police, Indian agents, priests. This, we didn't know. And my mother suffered the same thing. But she never, ever spoke of it to me. But we didn't know this was going on. Our generation didn't know it was going on for a number of decades already. But when we got back here, you see, we couldn't explain some of the things that were going on. The violence, violent conduct. Okay. We brought sicknesses home with us from the residential school, like a plague, sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse. We were never taught anything in that place that would nurture us or give us the tools to deal with what had happened to our culture, what had happened to our people. We were taught Dick and Jane. But we were never taught that there are these honorable teachings we call eternal laws, love, honor, respect. Not once did we hear the word treaty. We had corporal discipline on a scale that makes you sick. And it did make us sick. And we feel the effects of it today. You can see it in some of the people that get elected, because the Indian Act destroyed a system of government that survived us for generations and was surviving us up until the British came. And then the Indian Act came. This, you can see some of our people, they talk tradition. They talk culture. When just down to the marrow, it's all about the Indian Act. You got one plague after another. One plague after another. The latest plague is pharmakia, drugs. That's the latest plague. Plague of poverty. The genocide of the residential schools, the children's aid societies who were supposed to allegedly deal with our sufferings and our alleged inability to raise our own children.
Peter, I just wanted to ask you something. Peter, in just a few minutes, we're going to play two short little audio clips from testimonies from the residential school. They're about 4 minutes long. And I did want you to comment on that, because it's related to what you're talking about. But just before that, one thing that always discourages me and has for over 20 years is we've proven beyond any doubt that they kill children en masse, and yet the white culture reacts as, okay, here's a bit of money and we're sorry, now it's all fixed. How can people do that? Like, I know it's a naive question, but isn't it evidence that nothing has ever changed if they could go ahead with such heartlessness, the same lack of humanity that drag you away at gunpoint, is today saying you're healed now, you shouldn't have anything to worry about?
that's a pile of. I mean, we talk healing. We've heard of healing, but the whole apology in my view, in my experience, was a sham. It was a ruse. It was the DOJ, Department of Justice, and the Prime Minister's office. They knew exactly what they were doing. They did not come forward willingly and say, "Hey, we made you suffer. We want to deal with your pain and that we caused." They had to be literally dragged by the scruff of the neck to a situation where they could, and they blew it. They blew it. All we got was a cost-saving measure.
Right.
And we watched as the Prime Minister of Canada, Harper, and his government, PC government, gave rapists and murderers of little children de facto immunity. They knew exactly what they were doing, because a few years before, we had to take over an Air Force base in Portage la Prairie when I was chief here, which is different from the Ogie mob I did, but I was the lucky chief, to press our claim. On that land there, the DOJ lawyer was speaking to our lawyer about the residential school business, and they were already setting out the meat market approach. Right, if you were raped, beaten, nearly killed, whatever.
Yeah, the point system.
It was capped at $250,000.
Yeah.
So as people begin to find that out, and then they find out the number of deaths, our schoolmates. Okay. Is the apology worth anything? Not to me. Not anymore.
How do you apologize to over 50,000 children who died? I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, one thing you don't do is deny it. Right? One thing you don't do is make records disappear. One thing you don't do is make it arduous for some people who suffered, and then to treat them like a piece of shit, really, excuse my language, everyone,
yeah.
When courts have awarded four or five times that amount. The Department of Justice and the Government of Canada, not my neighbors. I do not afflict my neighbors with anything on this matter, unless they were there personally. But none of them were. But they knew exactly what they were doing. And it was a cost-saving measure, pure and simple.
Peter, let's play these two clips now. We'll just take a short break and listen to these two statements, one from Irene Favel from Saskatchewan and another, Del Riley from Ontario, both of them residential school survivors.
Here we are, second day of the dig, near the Mushhole. And this is an area about 100 yards from the school where we found consistent bone samples. And these regular types of buttons, probably off of, well, clothing obviously. But the interesting thing is here and at the Glebe site, they're of the same style as if they're off a standard uniform or something. Could be a child's button off a school uniform.
My name is Del Riley. I'm a member of the Chippewa of the Thames. And I spent 5 years in the Canadian government calls it residential schools, but really these were prisoner of war camps. I was in the one called the Mohawk Institute. And I do believe it had the reputation of being the worst of all the residential schools. There is such a thing, because they were all horrible. But I did 5 years here, and it was a most horrific experience any human being could possibly go through. And probably from being every one of the 6-year-olds I was in here was sexually abused, and myself as well, multiple times. Double-digit figures, so every one of them. It happened to all of us. And they starved us, beat us, froze us. And it was horrific. There was no controls in the place. Kids were always getting beat up or being put through various torture rituals. Well, I want the story to come out. I want the world to know what has happened to the kids here. The fact that thousands upon thousands were killed here. It was a Holocaust for our kids. And then have to suffer now through the fact that most of those little kids they killed off, nobody knows who they were, where they're buried, went home. So I don't know how we're going to deal with that, but we have to deal with that.
People and how communities are starting the process of moving on.
I'm Irene Fable, I'm 75. I went to a residential school in Muskogee in 1941 to 1949. And I had a very, very rough life. I was mistreated in every way. It was a young girl, she was 7 years old. She was pregnant. And what they did, she had her baby. They took the baby, wrapped it up in a nice pink outfit, took it downstairs. I was in the kitchen with the nun who were cooking supper. They took the baby into the, where they make a fire and all that to heat up the school, furnace room. They threw that little baby in there and burnt it alive. All you could hear was, that was it. And you could smell the flesh cooking. It's a big mistake when people say we were treated good. No way. There's a lot of things that happen in those boarding schools.
I would assume in any civilized society, and I assume I'm using the word lightly, but there's reports of murder like this, that children being thrown in furnaces. We documented 28 mass grave sites across Canada. We sent that to the media, the police, no response. Now, in any society, you'd think if there is a report of a death, it'd be investigated. But not only isn't it investigated in Canada, but they go after the people who report it, and they exonerate the people who caused it. So, I mean, in this kind of setting, how is it that we can expect any kind of justice unless we create it for ourselves? And yet, from your experience, when you try to do that, bang, you go right up against the system, and you get they come down on you big time, as you've experienced. So how do the few of us who are trying to fight this thing, how do we endure? How do we keep going when this is what we're facing? What are your thoughts about anything?
This lady was saying, up to 3 years ago, I went to a Assembly Manitoba Chiefs meeting, I think it was 3 or 4 years ago, and one of the young men there told me the same thing, that his mother, I believe his grandmother, had witnessed the same thing happening here in Manitoba. So it's like, I think Canada knew exactly what they were doing. They knew if there was an apology that most of the people don't want to see this. Even some of our people don't even want to talk about this stuff. But Canadians generally, they don't want to hear about it. They feel compassion, I believe that. But I think we have a duty, a positive duty, a spiritual duty to those babies that lost their lives, to those families who couldn't grieve for their children, who never saw their children's bodies even to grieve over and to put into the earth. We have a duty to, if it takes the remainder of our life, to continue to expose, to continue to share, to continue to push. Because you are targeted if you stand up against the current system, which is what I've been doing for most of my life. Even amongst our own people, I can tell you that some of that brainwashing did work. When they say tradition or culture, some of them, or Christian, some of them, but they leave their faith at the door and they bow down to the Indian Act. And it did work. When the white man speaks, they say, "How high, master?" And I can see it, because I was there once. But we have to continue with the spiritual warfare. And when they do come at you, and they did like it did to me when I was chief, and thereafter, they use medicine, they use sorcery, witchcraft, fear, the psychology of fear. They use direct medicine. They use shake tent. They use loosening your wheels. They use beatings. I faced off with a 303 British and a 30-30 Winchester. That's how intense these things can get. It's hard right here. It's hard here. And what? How do we keep on? How do we keep on? I have to look my children in the face. The same with my grandchildren. I will not lie to them about what happened here. I will not lie to them about the world they're living in. And the latest plague is crushing us. But we're still struggling. We can't give up. There's days that it's so oppressive. You just lay there. Because I'm living it, I'm seeing it right here.
Yeah.
I don't have to go anywhere else in Canada to see the effects of what has happened to our people. At the same time, the hardest thing that we are dealing with is our own oppression, our own oppressors. Okay. And that's the greater struggle for us. Because if we can't overcome these things ourselves, then we're finished. We're finished. We're Canada's good little Indians, third or fourth class citizens, good brown little Canadians. I teach my children clearly they are not Canadian. They're Ojibwe and Lakota. And I explain to them why when they're at their age to understand. And it's not about pride. It's about honor. It's honoring God. It's honoring each other. It's right. Honoring our broken families, our crushed families. It's honoring their memories of the ones that did make it out of there. Because we're still suffering from it. It's like a fallout. It's a genocidal collateral damage. And it is hard. It's hard to see young people, a young generation. I'm 64. It's hard to see a younger generation going through something. It's like a vacant walk. They don't want tradition. They don't want Christianity. There's nothing really spiritual about the way they're walking. So we can't quit.
No.
We just gotta keep going. And you know, we gotta keep telling our people that Canada, the judicial system, Sinclair, Laforme, whoever, any other judge that could have been appointed, they were handcuffed from the word go.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about
they still have that duty to act on their own conscience, to act on the facts, to take off those handcuffs themselves and show some judicial courage. Because, like I said, the last radio time we were on the radio, the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs passed a resolution directing Sinclair to address the question of genocide. Because I sponsored that resolution, and it was clear. And when I hand-delivered to him in Ottawa, he just kind of walked away. But I already knew he was handcuffed. I knew that when he was at the Forks here.
Do you mind telling listeners who Sinclair is?
He's one of the first judges here in Manitoba, I believe. He did the Aboriginal Justice Inquiry back in the 80s, I believe it was, with Hamilton, Chief Justice Hamilton, I believe it was, and which was a tremendous undertaking. Okay, it did reveal the flaws. It gave our people a chance to speak on some of those issues. But even at back then, there was a couple of us here at Long Plain who went in front of Sinclair and Hamilton and were trying to explain to them the oppression that we were living under at that time. And we were literally ignored then. See? But he was appointed to deal with this, this TRC. But I found out that it was a backward approach. During that time at the Forks, I think there was some kind of a session sponsored by the University of Manitoba. And there was, I think, four panel people on the panel. One of them was from South Africa. My understanding of that process was they got the offender and the offended together. They talked it over, forgive or not forgive. I'm just giving you a short version. And then they set the damages. That's my understanding. Here in Canada, at Southport, here in Fort de Prairie, Canadian Air Force Base, the rules were already being laid down. That was about just after OCA, 1990. Because I went to OCA, right. And then I come home, and we pressed our claim.
Well, also, you know, at the
but
TRC...
it was already set.
The so TRC didn't
by the
allow...
time it got in the hands of the individual, how can you say no? Do you understand? It was done. The deal was done.
They didn't allow testimonies to be shared when it involved...
Yeah, it was a big sellout. Yeah. If the only measure that we have right now, if the only measure we have, and I believe it's all we have, is the financial one, we got burned, and badly. We didn't just have one offender, like the Mount Cashel. The offender was the Roman Catholic Church. We had two offenders. The churches, the mainline churches, and the state of Canada. To me, we got burned badly. It was already set at 250,000, whatever it was. It was already capped back. I think it was 90, 91, 92 we took over that Air Force base. So in Fontaine, and those people that did this, and I'm not flogging them, they did one tremendous thing. They opened it up at least. And it did get a lot of people to talk about it, but still we got burned. We got burned.
Peter, I had a question. If you, you know... The longer we try to get justice in the system that is not going to give it, it's not even your system.
Oh, wow.
It kind of forces us to say, well, what do we have to create as an alternative? And is there anything within your tradition in terms of how you used to work out disputes in terms of your own legal system and that? Is there anything like that that you could bring to bear now, or is that a real option for your people?
In the 90s, because OCA did, the Mohawk peoples did spur a lot of revival in terms of our political lives and our legal, judicial lives and all those types of things. We had long claimed here, working with the elders from Sandy Bay and Swan Lake, which is part of the Elko Band of 1871. We began to undertake a process following the Rosa River Anishinaabeg. They were developing redoing... trying to restore their clan system and that structures and their judicial structures and all these things. And we were on our way. We were also doing the same thing. We were working to get rid of the four councils and the one chief, elected officials. We said, well, to the greatest degree possible at that time in our history, let's look at the spirit and intent of those traditions. What did the elders really mean? And how do we come out of this darkness and begin to restore our traditional governance? It didn't happen overnight. We began to work at it. Lots of debate, lots of arguments. I don't think we ever had a fight, I don't think. But real heated debate, because you're dealing with people's psyche and the way they've been taught to think. But a lot of people did shed that garment, the Indian Act, and they began to really see what we were supposed to be about. So we began to slowly restore the families, and this is as equals. Because if you go to the Indian Act, you're finding all across this country, you'll hear it all the time, Canadians hear it all the time, one power group, one family.
Yeah.
They got the votes, they got the money, they got the power. But that's what we were battling, and we wanted to restore that, and we were on our way there. The last thing that we were going to start, and I think, believe this is what scared some of the people out here, some of the guys anyway, some of the men out here, former politicians, you know, former chiefs, former counselors. We had started to work with the women to restore their authority, even though we didn't fully understand what that authority was at the time. I cannot say to you that I fully understood what their role was or what their authority was, because even then, as a chief, and although I'm an Ogima, I know what I am, I was still learning. And as we got closer and closer to reestablishing the woman and their role, not only in our lives, but in our government, because we found out they had such a powerful goal. They are the hindrance to corruption of the Ogima, or for people who don't understand that, say the chief. I found out it was the women who had to sanction what Ogima Yalakul said before August 3, 1871 at the Stone Fort, the clan mothers, they called them. So we were restoring, we were working it out, you know, like, let's dig deeper. And that's when we collapsed. Internally, some of the former chiefs got together, got the big families together, and right today, I'm fighting the same battle as we were in the 80s. Same battle. And no help. Indian affairs, it's like I'm back with the Indian agents, pure and simple. Mm-hmm. There's a little god at the office. And the only way to fight that spiritual warfare is to pray and fast and pray and get others to pray. But you also must do. These people have learned to use that dollar and hire white cockroach lawyers to oppress their own people. Mm-hmm. We can fight these things. But if you haven't got a dollar, okay, if you are blacklisted, like I am, with all the organizations, even my own, the Dakota Ojibwe Tribal Council, mm-hmm, then how are you expected to fight what these people are doing? They're neglecting the youth. They're neglecting the language. They're neglecting our traditional governance. They're even violating our treaty. I'm trying to get two cases forward on two issues of treaty, one of them being health. They're violating the children's rights to education. The fight for our governance is not with the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs in Canada or the Southern Chiefs Organization in Canada. It's right here in Long Plains and other First Nations who are fighting the same battle. One voice. That's all it takes to keep it alive.
Peter, that's a good point to end on. Now, we're going to have you back again. We're almost at the end of our time. I've just got a few final reports, but I want to thank you again, brother, for being on. And the wisdom and power of your words, I know, are reverberating everywhere. And we've got a lot of good feedback every time you're on the air. So I want to thank you. And we'll have you on again soon to continue on this conversation. Thank you, Peter.
Well, it's an honor and a privilege. Like I said, Cap Young Barracks, I live in a community where free speech is hard to come by at times.
Right.
But I'm thankful for the opportunity to for other First Nation listeners to know that they're not alone.
Right.
That we're in the same struggle. And that we hold hands in our hearts. And we seek that lifeblood of nations, as I said it, as I call it, as justice. That's the lifeblood of all, even Canada. It's Canada's lifeblood. And if it doesn't have it, we see the result. Someone suffers.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you, listeners.
Thank you for having. Now, we've only got about 2 minutes left, but after that, it's in a way hard to speak. But I do have something I wanted to say, and that is to my own people who are listening. And that is, we are not obligated to live under a regime that has caused mass murder, is continuing to cause that same crime across our nation. And under international law, we have withdrawn our allegiance from the Crown of Canada, the Dominion of Canada, and its crown, so-called crown laws. Last year, in January 2015, we established a new legal framework called the Republic of Kanata. Kanata, from a Haudenosaunee word, which means where the people sit around the council fire as equals. And that is our vision of Kanata, the Republic of Kanata.
we have established a new framework that people can belong to. The fact that genocide was committed by church and state and then concealed by them has disestablished Canada and its churches from any legitimate power, any authority, and it's freed citizens from their obligation to that government. It means you not only don't have to, but you shall not pay taxes to that government, because doing that is committing a crime. You're aiding and abetting a criminal power. As you are aiding and abetting a criminal power when you put money in the collection plate in a United Catholic or Anglican church. So not only are we freed from that obligation, but we are obligated to create a new authority, and that's what we're doing under common law. This is the voice that you're hearing every Sunday at this time on Radio Free Canada. This is our purpose, and this is why we have brothers like Peter Yellowquill on, to show that this is not just about whites or natives. This is a genocide aimed at all of us. It was aimed at my ancestors who fled Ireland and England. It's aimed today at every one of us who speaks out. It's killing our people. And it's now a time to put aside the differences and unite from the heart in the way that Peter so eloquently said today. Here's our purpose. That is why we're here. Write to us, republicofcanada@gmail.com. Talk to us more about how you can be involved. And we will be back next Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, itccs.org, murderbydecree.com. Do the homework. Get on board, brothers and sisters. We're going to end on this inspirational voice from the past about our forebears in England. And until next week, stay strong and stay clear. Thank you.
In 1649, to St. George's Hill, a ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. We come in peace, they said.